Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Tuesday to you. Welcome to the ICAT Task Force. Quick roll call. We have Cheryl Turney, Alex Goff, our two co-chairs, Alexis Snyder, Anil Jain, Deb Strickland, Jim Durgis, Jocelyn Keegan, Mary Green, Ram Shuram, Rich Landon, Sasha Termott, Steve Brown. Any other task force members that I may have missed? Okay, I would also like to welcome our guests from EHRA. We'll let them introduce themselves later, but first I'll turn it over to our co-chairs to get us started.
Well, thank you, Lauren. This is Alex Goss, and I'm going to kick us off today. We're going to have, as Lauren noted, our EHRA presentation. We'll then follow that up with a brainstorming session around prior authorization recommendations. We'll, of course, have our public comment and then move into next steps. So if we're going to go ahead and stay on track today, I'd like to propose that we go one more slide. Thank you very much. As in our due form, we like to just kind of orient folks to what we discussed in the last call before jumping into the deep end of the pool for today's topics. So in the last meeting, we had a really robust discussion around a business process model. It was a very impressive model, very well presented by Robert. We're very grateful for his support and effort in transforming a narrative into a very polished end product, really focused on the automated aspects of prior authorization between the provider and the payer. We clearly identified some opportunities to further expand upon the patient interactions and what was envisioned as sort of the ideal state moving forward for automation, and that was a part of our discussion in understanding really what was the objective of producing that model. It's a little confusing about the care setting and possibly whether it was current and future state, and I think we became very clear that it was really a focus of the future around the automation aspects of what we've already discussed so far for our ideal state. We know that there's some opportunity to leverage this work as we move forward with generating our report. And so as we are continuing to identify other subject matter areas that we need for the report, like the recommendations, we're going to be revisiting that. We've been coordinating with Steve and Robert and Jim and some others offline in regards to how to best use that report. And so we're continuing to consider that work, as Cheryl and I have also been working on preparing a framework for the report that will address not only the prior authorization focus, but our larger discussion of the intersection of clinical and administrative data. So we're going to leave you with a teaser of more to come on that. We've started a framework for the report, and we're definitely going to be doing a shout out to get some leads for various sections to help us bring that home over the next 6 to 8 weeks. But without further ado, I would like to introduce Hans. I think, Hans, you're the only one presenting today from EHRA, but you may have other colleagues with you on the call. Electronic Health Record Association is a portion of HIMSS, and it's a trade association of electronic health record companies addressing national efforts to create interoperable electronic health records in hospital and ambulatory care settings. The association operates on the premise that rapid, widespread adoption of EHRs will help improve the quality of patient care, as well as the productivity and sustainability of the healthcare system. And as a part of our engagement with industry and learning from those on the front lines, receiving some additional thoughts for consideration, we're rounding out a series of presentations today with Electronic Health Record Association, and we're really excited to have Hans present to us today on behalf of that committee.
Thank you, Alex. I hear a echo in front of you. I will sound.
I'm hearing an echo too, Hans. Has it gotten it any better for you?
Yeah, I see an echo from you and from me.
You're breaking up. I think it might be on your end. Are you on your computer, or are you – you're dialed in, right, with a headset?
Dialed in, voice over IP. And it wasn't out there when I initially.
So, operator, could you possibly they're texting me via our chat buttons. They're working with the operator on improving your clarity of your line, Hans. We think it's your line is breaking up.
And you may just want to use, just if you can, just a phone line and not over the computer. That may be where the feedback's coming from. If you have audio both from your phone as well as the computer. Hans, we'll send you a note separately, but if you can hear us and you're able to dial in from a landline or a separate line, that may be better.
If you can hear me, I'm going to try to dial in with a cell phone this time over a different channel. So I'm going to hang up
Okay, but all of a sudden you got really better, Hans.
Yeah,
okay, I'm not going down. I didn't do anything. All right. I like it when that happens.
Okay,
right. So let's give it a try until before it strikes again. So really appreciate the opportunity on behalf of the HRA to talk with this committee a little bit further about prior authorization. And as a little introduction to EHRA, I'm not sure, I know a number of people on the committee, but not everybody. I'm not sure how familiar you are. But we have on the next slide, we have about 30 members that are part of the organization, and as Alex indicated, is that we really are trying to focus on enabling our clients, the industry, with capabilities that support directly our clients, providers in the healthcare settings, and it's a wide range: hospitals, ambulatory, also post-acute. So there are a number of different settings there, as well as their interactions with any of the stakeholders that they need to get data from, or that they need to provide data to, whoever that may be. So in that context, I want to share a couple of thoughts around prior authorization. So if you go to the next slide, we believe, and I clearly agree, that we need to streamline. We hear from our clients frequently that the process, the steps, the documentation, all the things that are needed to get prior authorization for the items that that are being ordered, considered, otherwise, that is taking a lot of time, effort, and it has a number of challenges in a variety of different ways. So I wanted to touch on some of those challenges today. But we clearly agree that we have to figure out something collectively to improve on that, and it will require participation and effort across a number of different parties. It's not only the EHR, it's not only the providers, it's not only the payers. It is everybody collectively to make something better out of what we currently have. So if you go to the next slide, when we look at the prior authorization, I'd like to make a distinction between prior authorization for medications and for everything else. For prior authorization for prescription medications, we see a much more widespread introduction of that, and with the efforts and the connections through Cover My Meds and SureScripts, is that there has been a substantial uptake on that, which we clearly have seen across the provider community a substantial benefit of that. And with the adoption of the latest script standard, has further enabled improving on that on those capabilities. So, in the medication area, we are very pleased about how far we have been able to collectively get. In the area of other services, clearly we have been collectively lagging. There's more to be done. Attempts had been made in the past to do some of the efforts, but generally we ran into some challenges on actually making that work and fit that into the workflow as easily. So if we go to the next slide, some of the challenges that that we recognize and hear about is about the lack of or the level of detail at which prior authorization is required. So it needs to be done for individual procedures, individual tests, individual DME equipment, individual services where that may be required. And the data requirements and the need for it varies. It varies by payer, federal, state, commercial, as to when does somebody need to have authorization for what. So it's not only that the number of items that a prior authorization needs to be done for is high, but then also that the variations in what is needed to do so, to request for it, if it's needed or not, is a substantial variations in that, and that makes it very challenging to manage that. Additionally, to date, it has been a challenge to have efficient data exchange methods and technologies with the payers to interact with them, as attempts using X12 and infrastructures that were in place just did not enable us to integrate the flow and the data as easily into the workflows with minimum impact on the user. Delays, lags that occur because the technologies were just not there to have a smooth interaction. So that has made it challenging as well to make the necessary progress. And then overall, data capture, workflow integration, how to ensure that it sits in the right spot, in the right place, has been challenging with the variety of data requirements that are needed. So a recognized set of challenges there that we need to figure out how to overcome that. So if you go to the next slide, clearly the EHRs have good amount of data available relevant that to the prior authorization. But the need for prior authorization at the time of order is not always clearly understood. So there is a understanding of when do I need it, when do I not, and just mentioned that earlier as well. It requires additional documentation that is needed beyond what otherwise might be needed for treatment. So there are the question then becomes is that we are trying to support our clients with the appropriate amount to perform their activities, clinical, otherwise, administrative, et cetera. But this requires additional documentation to support the authorization request, which is then additional to everything else they need to do, which can increase the burden of documentation. It is also not always clear what additional documentation is needed for whom. Yes, there is some general guidance on that is available through portals and otherwise, but it is not that easily obtainable and that you can make that efficient process work within the workflow. Data may not exist in the EHR itself. It might be sitting in a different system that might be relevant, document management systems that are associated with, but there might be other places that we need to go depending on the configurations that are in place. So it's not necessary that all the information is in one system. It might be distributed across a couple of different systems that is needed. And then the lags that we have experienced in accessing, exchanging with payer systems, if that is not fast enough, if that does not fit within the workflow of the user, then at that point in time, it's not going to be very successful to get it up and running. And when we look at those challenges is that they are projected frequently and unfortunately onto the EHRs, rather than the combination and particularly the additional data requirements, the infrastructure that need to be in place on the other side to be able to get access to the information in a timely fashion and to make it work. So again, like anything, interoperability, it is not a one side and it works. It is an issue and a challenge that needs to have participation and contributions by everybody to make it work, so that the systems on both sides are in place, standards are in place, accepted, and the technology is efficient enough to make it work for the user. Next slide, please. So a couple of recommendations that we see that should be considered fall in the following four buckets generally. First, where possible, where it is possible to provide authorizations already at a higher level than the individual procedure service test or DME would be very helpful. And the shift from fee-for-service to value-based payments has that opportunity to identify based on patient condition, based on other more general criteria, is there a set that is effectively then already authorized once you are in that category? Where can that be done? Or the fact that you're in value-based payment, are there scenarios based on shared risk that the need for prior authorization is not as essential? It's more on the back end as part of the reporting that is sufficient. So are there opportunities by which there is effectively no need for authorization to be embedded as deeply into the workflows and at each individual procedure, service, et cetera? So that's one area to look at. What can we do there so that it's not needed? Second recommendation is that we all collectively work on how can we integrate it into the EHR workflow, and so that we are less reliant on separate payer third-party portals to get access to that information, but to put it in line. And there are a couple of different ways that that are currently being explored in DaVinci in particular, other places, to see how can we make that happen. So there is still a fair amount of work to be done there, but if we can integrate it, but the key is how can we do that with the least amount of extra documentation requirements, data capture, and offline interaction with the payer. So automating data capture and prior authorization requests as much as possible is essential to make that happen. Otherwise, it adds to the burden, and that's not going to work. So we need to be looking at the technology standards that are better suited to the real-time interactions across systems. And with the recent developments around CDS hooks, RESTful, HL7 Fire, Smart, there's a toolkit that is starting to become available that has the opportunity to establish the level of integration and interaction that makes it more viable than what we had available before. So those are the main areas where we are looking at on how we can make progress and work together to make that happen. If you go to the next slide, then we actually already are in the questions and answers. So I didn't want to go too much deeper at this point in time, but rather hear questions that you have, areas that you would like to dive a little bit deeper to have that discussion. But generally, reemphasize, there is a need, there is an interest, and we need to work together to figure out how we can best integrate this. There might be a couple of different paths to achieve that, and there's not necessarily one way that we need to all have to do it, but there are common characteristics of how to make that happen that can enable the users to have a better flow of their prior authorization and a less burdensome flow of the prior authorization. I'll stop there and pass it back for any questions or comments or discussion.
Well, thank you, Hans. This is Alex again, and what I'm going to do is facilitate the Q&A portion of this spot of our call. And the way we handle this is we have our members raise their hands, then I'll call on them, and then we'll ask questions. I am thinking it might be useful to go back to the prior slide because there may be some questions on that. But before I make that leap, I'm going to first call on Alexis Snyder, as you have your hand raised.
Thanks, Alex, and thanks for the presentation. I had one question when you talked about perhaps diving a little bit deeper. Your first recommendation on the list to establish authorization at a higher level than the procedure itself, you referenced the move from fee-based care to more value-based care system and how that would be helpful. And so I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more.
Yes, the question is that at this point in time, particularly on the fee-for-service, is that authorization is needed for a number of procedures, services, et cetera, individually as they are being ordered, as they're being considered. And the question then comes up is that if a patient falls in a certain category based on their condition, diagnosis, or otherwise, however that can be reasonably established, and that I'm not a clinician, so I leave that to clinicians to provide more background on that. But given that, are there then a certain set of procedures, tests, equipment, otherwise, that are expected to be part of the care, of the healthcare delivery, that therefore the fact that you are in that category of care, you don't need to ask for authorization individually for each and every time that I now need to order a particular test or not. It's already part of that quote-unquote package. So that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it in that context is to say, If value-based payment programs are risk-based, and therefore there's an incentive on both payer and provider side balance the quality and the cost, is that at that point in time, is that sufficient incentives on everybody's part that there is appropriate ordering and placement and utilization happening, that therefore you also don't need to do that. There's still opportunity for analysis and looking for outliers and otherwise. Is that sufficient to, at that point in time, manage what we're trying to achieve, which is really balancing quality and cost? So it's just a consideration of, can we reduce the number of times that we need to ask for prior authorization on individual items?
Thank you.
Next in the queue, we have Rich Landon.
Hey, hi, it's Rich Landon. I had two questions, but Alexis asked and you answered the first one. My second is also on the same slide. The fourth bullet, you're talking about some examples of better suited technologies and standards. Question is, does the current X12 transaction set fit into those new technologies and standards as a component, or would the X12 have to be abandoned completely in favor of these other standards and technologies?
That's a loaded question.
Yep.
Thank you for that. I would say is that if we are looking at the level of interaction and that is needed to communicate back and forth with payers, then at that point in time, the kind of data that needs to go back and forth, triggering to initiate when to ask for certain information, to obtain the information, then I think we're starting to see, certainly compared with attempts that have been made in the past, that these newer technologies, RESTful-based, that we see that the formats that are being used with the with the more nimble sizes that the HL7 FHIR can enable. We look at ensuring that there are appropriate security connections. It seems that this has very promising capabilities that move forward. We've already seen with the work from DaVinci that has been demonstrated that this is very powerful technologies that can be used. So like anything, is that I'll play and be a little bit more neutral in it. I think it has a lot of promise, and we need to look at that. We need to continue that and let it prove out. And if at that point in time it looks like that this technology can indeed much more quickly, efficiently manage the workflow between provider and payer, then let it take over. If not, then we have to look at it at that point in time again. But let not be the fact that there is currently a standard that has been very successful in a number of areas, but has been challenging to pick up in this particular space. Let that not sit in the way of exploring, moving this forward, and then based on the actual results, decide what to do next in light of the position of X12.
Any follow-up question on that, Rich? You good?
If I can find my mute button, I'm good. Thanks.
Thank you. Next in the queue, Jocelyn Keegan.
Hey, Hans. I think you did a great job with that answer. So I have two questions for you, and I love hearing from you with your EHRA feed on since I normally get to hear you with your DaVinci hat on. So the first is around, I think you did a great job of covering the existing EPA workflows with pharmacy. So I'm curious to know what you think about the integration of real-time benefit check into those workflows to replace some of the weaknesses around the existing formulary and benefit files. So that's my first question. And then my second question is, I know because we've had conversations, but can you unpack a little bit the idea behind smart applications and how you think that they could be used to improve or reduce the need for prior auth?
So on the real-time benefits, this is an interesting one because at times is that do we look at it separately from prior authorization or do we look at it together with prior authorization? It seems that the main question that one is trying to address with prior authorization is do I need to have that approval from the payer in context of the care and the condition of the payer to move forward with that, which is one thing. At the same point in time is that whether assuming that it has been approved or that it can be approved, but then together with everything else that doesn't need prior authorization, you have to question effectively real-time benefits, price transparency. You have the question of what is it going to cost to whom.
Right.
And I think they are not completely tied to the hip, but they're definitely related, that during the process, prior authorization initiated by the provider, real-time benefits, a combination of provider and patient, consumer, to make an informed decision as to is that the right thing to do in the context of the financial implications, which needs to at times be considered as well. So I would keep them somewhat separate in that, particularly since real-time benefits and price transparency needs to be done regardless of prior authorization. That doesn't mean that in the workflow where that happens, that there might be a very natural place then that for those things that you do prior authorization, that you have the opportunity to then also look in that context in the real-time benefits aspects as well. Before I go to your other question, does that address your question?
That's great. I think it does, and I think that it's something we need to keep in mind, right, is that there's a codependency there, but RTBC sort of stands on its own, right, for other reasons.
Right. On the other part, I believe that your question was is that to go a little bit more about smart app and how they can play a role in prior auth. Is that the
mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think so, yeah. And if you from an EHRA perspective, is there any more sort of evolved thinking about what that role of that smart app is when we think about, you know, what we've been doing from a DaVinci perspective, but just in general about creating that transparency in workflow about a patient's benefit?
I cannot give you an EHRA opinion about of the two that I'm going to describe.
I'll go for a Hans opinion. That's okay.
Well, but EHRA has not really discussed, nor is it likely to discuss, say, one method that I'm going to describe and another method, which one is the one that we all do. I think there are effectively, at this point in time, two that are being explored and pursued, and that both have benefits and opportunities. And interestingly enough, they can utilize the same interactions with a payer. It's just being executed in a different spot. And there are pros and cons to either one. So no value judgment from an EHRA perspective in this part. The thing is that one approach is that you can take the interaction that you need to have with the payer. And you can fully, deeply embed it in the existing workflow that a either a clinician and or other administrative staff combination, typically based on where things are, to really initiate, do I need prior authorization? And then at that point in time, go out, come back with information. If there's a need for additional follow-up, it needs to go into a queue to have somebody else follow up on that, because the clinician is not going to stop for that. They want to progress. So there's always going to be a little bit of a multiple users that are going to be in play to do that. So you can deeply embed that into the workflow natively and make that happen. The other approach is that you take a smart app approach where those capabilities are extracted away a little bit more from the workflow. You can still integrate it with the workflow in that it's triggered by. That's where CDS hooks comes in play on either technique that you use. When do I need to ask for prior authorization? So something gets initiated. But then you have an opportunity for a smart app that you then interact with, who in turn can take on the coordination with the different payers, interaction with the payers otherwise, and identify what kind of data needs to be collected, go back, interact with the system using Firebase APIs to get the data, and at the time that they identify, oh, I need more information than I can get, I'm going to ask for that information. Similarly, if you have it deeply integrated, something similar would happen. How much information is available, and oh, I need to ask for these three extra things, whatever. But you would have a smart app effectively take care of that. Pros and cons to either approach, both very valid. And the interesting part is that the way that the interactions are being defined right now would enable either approach to be taken. So that we can explore as a community both of them, and some will find one to be a better fit, and others will find the other one to be a better fit. But both work. Does that help?
Thanks so much. That was great.
Yeah, so Hans, let me build, this is Alex, let me build on that. So we've got this ability to deeply integrate technology and workflows together in the EHR products or the platform that's being used by the clinician. We've also got this ability for these applications, these smart apps, to be bolted into that infrastructure that can do the calls and the queries back and forth and is sort of dependent upon the data being captured and stored in the right data element for the smart apps to leverage. Is that fair?
That's fair, and so you can use Fire APIs that already are existing or are emerging and are expanding on the EHR side to support your CDI and as that is growing. So you can utilize that. So the smart app can take advantage of that, can very consistently go from one system to another as that's, becomes more widespread. The other thing is that the smart app might have capabilities and other things that perhaps the EHR is not necessarily going to deploy as quickly, or there is not as big a need for it, but other ones in the smart app can more quickly deploy that or otherwise. So there's a variety of different sides of the coin that you can start to look at, that one is not exclusionary to the other. There are benefits associated with that. The smart app can evolve at its pace, and the EHR can evolve at its pace, and it depends on the parties what is most appropriate. So that's why I said there's no value judgment here of which one is better than the other. It all depends on the context of the EHR, the payers, and the smart apps, which one is fits best.
And I think we've seen over time that different organizations make different architecture and business investments and technologies. And so there is sort of meeting folks where they're at. And what I'm hearing you describe with this deep integration, workflow integration aspect and the smart app is that you're really, we've got the right tools and the toolbox right now to let the market innovate and really shake out what's going to work best and reduce burden the most. And one of the things I heard you say in your initial presentation of this slide of the recommendations, when you were referring to the fourth bullet, you said something about a toolkit availability. And then if you wanted to expand upon what is the toolkit, where does one get it, and how would it help with this market shaking out? What are the best models to really meet the workflows and the end users where they're at?
I think we need to look at the term toolkit there as we have the standards for CDS hooks that are emerging, evolving, expanding. So you see there a capability that that is starting to be included in a number of EHRs and that will be progressing that can help with triggering when should I invoke something out there based on where I'm at in the workflow. You see RESTful as a technique, a technology that can enable communication across the internet, web-based applications that it can support quite well, etc. You see with HL7 Fire a set of building blocks to define what data I need to be communicating, so they're effectively your resources, your building blocks, and you see Smart that when you are particularly using Smart Apps, that it can establish a authorization authentication environment. So when I said toolkit, I really mean it in that sense. So is there a single place right now that you can go to a store and get everything together in play and runs? Not at this point in time, but we do know that there are a number of parties that are pulling the pieces together. And are working on smart apps. There are people that are working to embed it in their EHR. So it is more in that sense that the toolkit is starting to have all the piece parts that you need to get started. DaVinci has been working on implementation guides folks are starting to work with. So in that sense, there are pieces of the puzzle that are starting to get to the point that you can say, yeah, I can seriously now try to make it actually happen in an initial capability. So we're getting there. We're not there literally at this point in time yet, but we're getting very, very close.
So Hans, as a sort of a wrap-up kind of portion of this today's agenda item, it seems to me that the interoperability rules of the patient access from CMS and the certification rules from ONC are really going to help put those pieces of the puzzle really at play within payer and provider and vendor organizations. And so that's a really big step to help us have the right pieces of the puzzle starting to come together in the technology choices that organizations will be making.
Right, and there's a lot of opportunity there to enable this kind of workflow. So yes, looking forward on how that is going to unfold. But there's quite a bit of opportunity to help out. But hopefully, we not only are going to just automate existing process and existing prior authorizations, but go back to the first bullet, harder opportunities to streamline that a little bit more, so that overall. The impact is lowered, the effort is lowered, and we can meet more efficiently progress with what we need to do.
That's an excellent wrap-up point on your part. Unfortunately, we do have one more question that came in the queue. Rich Landon?
One more question, Hans. In the slide before this, you talked in a couple of the bullets about orders. So I'm hearing then or reading that for the EHR to invoke anything with prior auth, there has to be some sort of order. But I'm struggling to understand what kind of order. Is it an order for prior auth that someone would enter? Or is there some sort of internal logic that as something as specific as a lab test or a radiology procedure is ordered, that would trigger a query out to the relevant health plan to determine whether prior auth is necessary or not, and then what data is necessary to support that. Could you talk a little bit more about that order concept and how that works in the EHR vision, HRA vision?
Yeah, there's probably a couple of places, and order is probably the most frequent one. If you take it, a synonym for order is prescription. So at time of prescribing, there is a need for a prior authorization. So that's a kind of order. If you need to have a certain lab test or certain image services, there is a need for a request or an order to that area. So that is typically the time at which it's contemplating. So, hey, we would like to do this. Therefore, we're finding out that, oh, we actually, to do it, we need the prior authorization. So if you take the concept of order more generically, there is a need to do something, and that typically then requires a request or a communication to another part of the organization or to another organization, that as part of that, I need to get authorization as well. So you can, depending on how quickly you can interact and obtain authorization, you have different points in the workflow that you can start that, or that you have to start it, or that you cannot complete it and finalize the request until you have obtained the authorization. So it is in that entire flow. I want to do something. There is a request. There's an order. There is an appointment that I would like to make, but I first need to make sure that I have authorization to visit. So there's a number of different words that could be used. I probably should have used a more generic term than order.
And how does that fit with the first EHR recommendation on the next slide that talks about establishing authorization at a higher level than a procedure for service?
Right. So what that would mean is that right now, if I'm requesting a procedure or a visit or ordering a service or a test or ordering DME, is that rather than having to invoke every time that I'm in initiating or starting that workflow in a way, that at that point in time, I need to invoke, evaluate, and submit perhaps a prior authorization request to the payer, is that rather than doing it every time, can we, based on characteristics of the patient and the relationship and what kind of are they part of ACO in a program, fee-for-service. Fee-for-service, perhaps I need to do it more at the individual levels. If I'm in one of the other programs, I may need to do it less because there's already an understanding that if this is what you're ordering, you don't need it. It's already assumed to be in place, or you're taking on the risk. So it's okay. Take on the risk.
Okay, thanks. That's very clear now, and I get it. But if there's one order that triggers the whole suite, that ties in nicely to a conversation we had on task force a month and a half, months ago. I had, when you first presented this first bullet there about the higher level, I had assumed erroneously that was more prior off based on a clinical condition rather than a request for specific service. So thanks for that question.
Well, thank you so very much, Hans, for delivering some thoughts and considerations for the task force to consume as we advance our work towards prior authorization recommendations. We appreciate the time and energy that your team put together in preparing EHRA's content. And thank you so very much for joining us and answering all of our questions today. Very helpful.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. Have a great rest of your day, Hans. So folks, we're going to now pivot to the prior authorization recommendations brainstorming. Hopefully you can all see the document that I'm sharing. It is the Google document that is actually started out as being the guiding principles and future state document. We've looked at this previously a couple times, especially most recently when we reviewed the privacy and security information from the small work group. What we did was to build on that framework of guiding principles and ideal state, where we had a variety of categories that we had identified, and a small work group got together to create a starting point for recommendations. And we've had a handful of calls. We have, as a team, identified some initial brainstorm of policy levers that we might want to be considering as we move forward. We've also talked about some of the orchestration and implementation opportunities. So let's think of this as policy levers or things that can happen within the federal government, control and authorities, rulemaking, guidances, et cetera. We think of the orchestration and implementation aspect related to the technology standards and rules and the industry level of activities that can happen. We have a strong industry association community. We have federal advisors. We have others that are working together collaboratively to try to improve the process overall through their varying influencing capabilities, such as, you know, influencing legislation that may be emerging. So I offered this as sort of a kind of a getting your head into the recommendation space that we really want to continue to build on the work of the small work group. We haven't seen their recommendations work yet. This will be the first foray into the group discussion. We have tackled the items in black on this list, meaning that the last five bullets, we've done a preliminary tackling of recommendations for those, including the uncategorized one option, which we've subsequently relocated to putting in the section of patient at the center during our discussion yesterday. We have four areas that we have not done any brainstorming, and to help us sort of all get in the creative wordsmithing and idea generation process, we thought today that we would start tackling these four areas. So we'll see how far we get today, and we'll continue the work next week. Before I get started any further, I want to stop and see if there's any questions about what we're going to be doing today in going through the first four bullet areas of categories and trying to, I'll do a brief recap of what the category itself has indicated and then open it up for ideas from the membership. I believe Cheryl is going to help me with managing Q&A here. At least that's what I remember from our call yesterday, Cheryl, keep me honest.
Yep, absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Thank you. And so before we get started, just any general questions about what we're doing, why we're doing it, and how it's going to be used? Okay, I'm not seeing any hands pop up. So without further ado, let's take a look. For those of you who are on the small working group, you may have noticed I reorganized a few of these, and I just did this for simplicity purposes so we wouldn't be jumping around in the document. I didn't want to make everybody dizzy today through our working of the document. So first one is real-time data capture and workflow automation. This is a pretty extensive set of ideal state attributes. Some of this we've seen in our recent business process modeling, but let's just kind of dust ourselves off as to the scope of the ideal state of routinely collecting or nearly all the data during the ordering steps. And regardless of the venue of care, the prior authorization process mechanically should be similar for the clinician and the patient, regardless of the health plan, since patients move across the healthcare ecosystem. We further went on to say we should support automation of ordering and prior auth processes for medical and equipment through adoption of standardized templates, elements, and real-time transactions. Any workflow utilized to support the prior authorization should auto-generate editable content to document the progress notes and visit note, the medical necessity, so the clinicians don't have to re-document what they just did to justify their prior authorization request. All insurance coverage will be identified and related
I think we lost Alex's audio. I just texted her to let her know.
Okay, thanks. Hopefully she'll come back in. Well, while she's coming back in, what she was reviewing was the information that had already been signed by the group as, information to share and then get input from this larger group. And I'm struggling to read what she's got. Unfortunately, I don't have my own copy of it. So if she was out on number six. It was information required for recommendations and decision-making should be provided one time by the source. So this is capture once and reuse, which is part of the underlying principles that we had identified for the group. Number seven was to automate prior authorization through Health IT and focus on what information can be exchanged to make any coverage decision better, faster, and more transparent. Am I hearing Alex back in? Nope, she's still on hold. All right, then the next is, again, collect once and reuse as permitted. So it looks like we're saying that in two different ways, but the same concept. Number nine is increase end-to-end automation for processing prior authorization data requests and response using recognized standards and code set values. Very important as we move forward to ensure that we're all speaking the same language as we're sharing the data for specific data fields. Number 10 was to protect continuity of care for patients who are on an ongoing active treatment or a stable treatment regimen when there are changes in coverage, health insurance providers, or prior authorization requirements. And this often happens when a patient moves from one plan to another or at the end of a plan year. Sometimes they're asked to resubmit all that data all over again with no apparent connection to what is changed. Does that mean they can't hear me now either? Okay.
No, you're good, Cheryl.
I can hear you.
So, okay. And that's particularly problematic, as you know, for patients because that often happens with medications. And also, I know my daughter has this happen a lot where they change the PBM vendor for some particular reason, for either specialty drugs or whatever. All of a sudden, she has to go through this prior authorization process that takes forever. And there's nobody who understands why she's going through it, and all of the data that was already collected never goes to the new provider. Number 11 was workflow practices include triggers for expiring prior authorization to prompt renewal activities if applicable. So that would be good to know before it expires so that patients and providers would know what they need to put in place, so the patient is not left where they're not able to get what they need. The number 12 was the greater use of clinical decision support tools. Somebody's got their, accountable care models and consensus-based guidelines to reduce the volume of prior authorization requests while increasing the value of responses and shared treatment decision-making. So this obviously would be very helpful in order to understand when a prior authorization really is necessary. I think this is where we're talking about things where if they request a prior auth and then a prior auth is almost always approved, then why are we, putting in the request for that if the clinical decision support model says that this care or treatment or test would always be required? Is Alex back on the line?
Line, and I thank you for walking us through those. I'm not really sure what happened there, but we seem to have a variety of us that are having phone line issues today. So I appreciate you tag teaming. I believe you walked us through those. And I think what we want to do is pivot to some general ideas that were starting to bubble up. We had some initial discussion around the aspect of potential recommendation areas we might want to think about. So these may help folks with raising their hand to make suggestions about specific recommendations. We've talked about multiple insurance dynamics and coordination of benefits and the complex nature of a wide net of insurance coverages and making sure that we understand those processes and who's covering a patient. Another area above and beyond and sort of related to multiple insurances is this idea of member ID cards and the fact that we don't have any standardization there. The aspect of normalizing EHR capabilities. Standards to support normalizing workflow with technology was another area we thought about, and some response time norms. So these were some preliminary areas that we thought might warrant specific recommendations building on the 14 points that we've reviewed.
Yeah, and if you want, Alex, I can start us off, and then I see Jocelyn is raising her hand, but I brought up the member ID cards. I actually had some meetings with some providers in the Connecticut area, and they all brought up, they were all small to medium size, the fact that member ID cards are problematic because there's no standards today for them. So even though they all have to either copy them or scan them, they're only saved as an image, and that data then has to be transposed into their mechanical or electronic system, and there's always an opportunity for errors. So what would be great would be to have a standard ID card format that could be digitized that all the payers would use, and that way when a patient presents their either digital or paper card, that data can be automatically captured in a digital way and the system can utilize it as is rather than having someone have to then transcribe the image or, figure out how to read the image. And so that was really where that came from. And it's probably more beneficial to the provider than the patient, but it will help the patient if the quality of the data is more accurate the first time that it's captured.
I noticed from one of our attendees in the public that there is a standard for health ID cards, and I also remember that there, thank you, Mary Kay, and I also remember that a Weedy had done some work around this space in the past, and so, I think the what I'm hearing is that we want to pursue a standardized member ID cards with an eye towards consumption, is the word I'm looking for, consumption of content into EHR or something like that. I hope I captured your thoughts there.
And I really appreciate the people that brought it up in the chat as well, because I wasn't aware that there was a standard and that just wasn't, it's great. The focus is on the fact that there are a lot of standards, but they're not required to be used. And so a lot of the vendors are not adopting them. So that's where the disconnect is, I guess. It needs to be updated so it is a requirement to be electronically captured. And we also do have a couple of people with their hands raised. So can I call on them as well, Alex?
Go for it. Thank you.
All right, Alexis, you had your hand raised first.
My comment was, or recommendation, et cetera, was in reference to the list that Alex started and then you picked up when we lost her audio. So I don't know if you can bring that slide.
I can, because it's all right here in the document.
So right there, yeah. So number 11, go back down.
This one?
Yeah, so workflow practices include triggers for expiring, which is great because I know we talked about that a lot. But I think that we could add a piece to that that we also talked about, which kind of tags teens with number 10. So if there's no changes and literally you've just been given a PA, say, for a medication and it expires 6 months later or a year later and nothing in your diagnosis has changed, you know, age hasn't changed, weight hasn't changed, there's no reason to really need another one except for the fact that it expired, you really should have a simple, streamlined process that doesn't start all over again to get a new prior authorization again. You should be able to just keep extending that expiration unless there's a change. I don't know how we want to word that, but I think that's probably an important piece. And then I just wanted to mention, as you were running through them, when you talked about wordsmithing, I really was not catching what number 12 was about at all until Cheryl started to kind of break it down for all of us and explain it further. So we may just need to revisit some of the, I was getting thrown off with the shared treatment decision and where that tied back in until she explained it.
Okay, I'll capture that one. So you gave us two things. So first, let me go down and try to capture this one, which is the something related to
kind of extending the life of the prior authorization.
Yeah.
Lieu
of
a starting new prior the whole process
off.
Over. Yeah.
For an move a new prior auth for a continuing service, establish, create, pursue renewal feature. I'm not sure if I think that captures at least enough of it. How else might you want me to?
Yeah, I think it does, except maybe after the continuing service. Just put like an IE, you know, ongoing medication, something like that.
Right. I do think, too, though, we should add the note, Alexis, if you agree, that, you know, simply because a payer changes PBMs is not a reason why the patient needs another prior authorization.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, like that does not seem reasonable at all.
It doesn't.
Okay, awesome. Next in the queue?
The queue is we have Jocelyn.
Just to tag on to that point that Alexis just made, I think it's really important. I do think that there is wording and intent in the CMS 22 pair rules. That we could build on around that portability of UM determination, I think that we should point to from a resource perspective. But I actually put my hand up and put my hand down and then put my hand back up about the idea of the member ID card, because I feel like, and I can't believe I'm going to say this out loud on a public standards call, I feel like the reason the member ID is so important is because we don't have a way to uniquely identify lines of business. And I think that, you know, when I entered healthcare IT from a different industry about 10 years ago, the concept of a plan ID was out there and it just died on the vine and never got implemented and enforced. But as our plan design gets more and more complicated, I do think that we need to revisit how are we uniquely identifying these products in the market? And if the most recent wave of mergers and acquisitions hasn't proven that point to us, I don't know what will, but I do feel like it's more than member ID, because if you can uniquely identify the product somebody's bought, it makes the patient-specific information so much less needed, which actually allows you to not have to deal in as much PHI. And I think that that's important.
So more than a member ID recommendation may be needed. So is that because you're getting back to the line of business? Yeah, like give me some more meat on that bone.
I think it's the ability to uniquely identify the actual product a patient has purchased or the employer group has purchased and that the member has purchased, to be able to understand what the attributes of that product are. When you look at the complexity of prior auth for something for CMS where everybody gets the same rules, it's just worlds of difference from as soon as you move into commercial or even MA lines of business, about really understanding what that particular line of business has for rules.
Right. That is particularly important, Jocelyn, when it comes to, like, the formularies that apply to each individual product. And I was talking to one set of providers at one point, and the real issue was that the software that they used didn't go down to the product level. So they would often think, oh, this is in the formulary, but then find out this employer group has scoped that out of the formulary.
A carve
out. There's no way to tell that if you don't go down to the product level.
So the sort of anecdotal, the anecdotal expression that I use is our ability to design products to sell and purchase healthcare has far outstripped our ability to manage those through anything other than the claims engine, right?
Yeah.
And one of the limitations is this ability to really understand which version of Plan X Gold are you actually talking about, because there's no unique identifier. So you have to go to the member date of birth. You have to go to PII to get an answer. I'm going to step off of my soapbox now.
Okay. Don't let it go too far away. We need more recommendations. All right. So are there any other hands up, Cheryl, that we should be looking for recommendations on this particular area?
I don't see any more hands up right now.
Okay. In lieu of that, in the time we have remaining before we go to public comment, I'm going to move on to the next one. Information security and privacy. So this one was laid out a little bit differently than our other items in that there were very clear guiding principles created, whereas the other parts, the guiding principles was sort of the category level. And from a guiding principle perspective, we really were making privacy and security foundational to, you know, in the design of everything that we wanted to do. And that whatever recommendations we have, they should meet the current health information and patient rights laws and regulations. The green text you're seeing here are the tweaks that were identified during the last task force meeting. And that the solutions that we design should meet the minimum necessary standard when requesting the disclosing information. And so we gave a couple examples related to that. And that whatever we recommend should continue to empower the patients to have a role in proactively providing and expediting his or her consent when required to share. This really then helped us with crafting an ideal state around prior authorization stakeholders achieving common agreement on implementation of prior auth minimum necessary protected health information sharing. The data elements that constitute that minimum necessary for prior auth would be identified and can be compiled efficiently to facilitate the goal of automating, very similar to what we've just talked about. That patients are empowered and understand their privacy rights and actively manage their consent for sharing, and that this includes the aspects related to that pesky little self-pay scenario and their ability to change perspectives on what they self-pay for versus not. That the consent format consistency is established for automated collection and use when required beyond TPO, our HIPAA framework. Streamlined or simplified individual consent collection processes are used for sharing individually identifiable information for prior auth when required by state or federal law by automating the process, informing the clinician prior to or close to the time of submitting the order that patient consent may be needed, and empowering the patient to have a role in facilitating and expediting the data collection process. There was a lot of discussion in our privacy and security work about the variability with state laws and that we need to address them from an inter and intra state perspective. So that's what's used not only within a state, but across state lines as patients move and plans may be selected. And there, that these laws we'd like to see addressed through automation, that would then help us with more easily instituting automation and logic to minimize the human interaction. So these are some of the recommendation or the ideal state areas. I'm going to leave this page up while I do a call for questions. Call for recommendations that you'd like to offer or any questions or clarifications you'd seek. Alexis?
Hi. On letter C, I suggest that maybe we reword it. Patients are empowered and understand their privacy rights. So you could, and I think I mentioned this before in a different one that we have some green notes on, and you can empower somebody all you want, but if the information is not understandable, I mean, that's different than empowering someone to look for it and understand it. So I'm not quite sure that this is making the point that you want. I don't know if I'm being clear, but when I read it, and even by empowering someone doesn't mean you're going to understand what it means. So right now there's a lot of loopholes, honestly, in privacy regulations and rights, and it's very, very difficult. So I think maybe transparency needs to be more in there than empower patients to seek it, but make it clear and transparent, something along those lines.
Yeah, I think that there was a robust discussion related to this one about when do we actually get down to the point of infusing education, our day in, day out education system, to actually speak to some of this, because people are just, I think, generally shut down to understanding some of their, they just see a HIPAA privacy form and they kind of sign it and they move on. They don't really take the time to understand the rights and opportunities and responsibilities related
right.
to it.
Well, most of the time it's not even transparent unless the patient asks, you know, specifically says, I want to see it. Most of the time you walk in and they say, oh, can you're exactly right. You get very used to the, oh, and here's the HIPAA regulations. Can you sign this? And it's usually an electronic pad and you haven't even seen it. So empowering people to ask for it or not even, just make sure that it's transparent before you ask. But even at that point, some of it is very difficult to understand. It just needs to be clear and transparent.
Yeah, that's a big implication. Do we think that there is a specific, you know, building on this comment, a clarity opportunity, do we think we could turn this into a recommendation, Alexis, along the lines of that kind of educational materials? I mean, I think the Office of Civil Rights has done an awesome job in translating HIPAA privacy and security rules into videos and fact sheets, but how, you know, I don't think that there's the average person going to the Office of Civil Rights to look up how do I need to interface with my providers related to the protection of my data and my authorities related to that. So just because we may have materials, you know, whether they're easy to understand and transparent is a separate piece, but it's also I think maybe we have two parts that are emerging. So I think that there is an education piece, clear and easy to consume, easy to understand, and then I think there's the availability or the performing the education. So there's education, there's clean understand materials.
I think we start to get in the weeds there, though, because, I mean, you know, we could go on and on with what that means, because clear and easy, depending upon how health literate you are, or even just how English literate you are, might be difficult.
So how do we want to make, let's avoid the rabbit hole there. I appreciate that. So if we need to have educational materials, I think we've got some of those out there already. Then if we've got educational materials need to be available, but how do we get the actual citizen to consume them, to absorb them, to understand them?
Well, I think that's part of the transparency. It needs to be clear at the point of care.
Alex,
it needs to be handed, given out links to where you can find more information.
Yeah, I think Deb Strickland has her hand up, and I think she's wanting to chime in on this particular conversation.
Can you,
so,
can you
yes?
hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can, Deb.
So I think that, you know, you got to hit them where they're at, right? And unfortunately, we're all at home right now. But in normal times, people would be in the waiting room of a doctor's office, in the waiting room of a lab, you know, maybe at a pharmacy or something of that nature. Maybe it's putting flyers, putting material that's very, you know, like one-liner, be, you know, something really easy, like four blocks of information. Do you know, you know, you have rights to this or whatever, and do like little posters so that people can just sort of glance at it and get that education. You know, having anything that's going to be in the documentation with font four, you know, no one's going to read that. So I think we need to hit them where they're at and try to get really basic high-level information out and available to them where they're going to be.
You can even extend that to telehealth, I mean, or even pre-registration, because if someone's online pre-registering and or using a telehealth visit, it's very easy to send that same thing that would be hanging in a waiting room via instruction page.
Yeah, or even dangling, you know, like those things, those stupid ads that are on, like, Facebook or whatever that kind of light up on the side or something like that, just to sort of be there on the page and be present so that they can actually look at them. And if they wanted more information, it could be a little bit of a clickbait where you could go in to get more, or it could just be there to send the immediate message.
I think that's what she said. Okay. Deb, your hand's still up. Are you another question or are you is that
no,
just a hanging chat?
I'm down.
No worries. I just didn't. Okay. So clearly education is something that we feel strongly about, and it's about getting the resources for key messaging to empower citizens. And the idea of we're going education to promote distribution vehicles to meet patients where they're at, and to do so in a ease. And I'm not sure how I want to go there with that, so I'm not going to right now. So I believe that we are now at the moment of needing to pivot to public comment. So I think we're going to do that before we continue. Lauren, are you going to review this, or would you like me to? Not sure if Lauren's still having audio issues. We would encourage anyone who is interested in making a public comment to follow these instructions.
If you would like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you so much. And this is Cheryl. We'll give it a minute to see if we get any comments. And if not, then we will move forward and take a pause if any comments come in. Do we have any requests for comment?
There are no public comments at this time.
All right, thank you. Can we move forward to the next slide? I know Lauren put the phone number in the chat. So we had a very rich discussion today, and I'm really happy about that. One of the things that Alex and I talked about as we're offline, looking at, you know, where are we against our stated objectives and timeline, is that we have created a lot of input for the team to react to. And one of the components of our final report that we would like to include is some gap statements I know we've done a lot of work on ideal state and our guidelines that we're trying to follow in terms of what we would like the end solution to look like. We've started working on recommendations. What's inherent there is our gaps, but we haven't actually documented gaps as a gap analysis. So we were wanting to reach out to the members of the task force to see if we could get someone to volunteer to review our materials to try to tease out some of the gaps that do exist that we've all discussed but haven't actually committed to writing. Is there someone on the task force that would be willing to take on that responsibility? I'm hearing crickets. No volunteers?
So Cheryl, well, you're envisioning that someone's going to, can you describe what you're thinking of the process that you'd like someone to undertake? Is it looking at past notes or how might somebody get started?
I think if they could review the ideal state and the, information that we put together for the data classes, all of those things, even our original workflow with the durable medical equipment, had inherent to it, you know, identified gaps. And we did discuss them, but we didn't really document them as gaps. So what I'm thinking is that if someone was willing to review the materials that we currently have available to come up with a gap list that we could then bring back to the group and we can expand out and utilize, it will help us because it will be easier in our final report if we can say, hey, this is the landscape of what we had looked at, what's currently going on. These are some of the gaps that we had identified and discussed, and these are some of the recommendations that we want to pursue to address those gaps. And I mean, one gap is the fact that today some of the processes for prior authorizations are not electronic. So we've already made recommendations that we haven't reviewed as a group, but we've talked about them where we want to have electronic capabilities to see, all the services that are required for prior authorizations. We want to know for each of those services what the documentation requirements are. Well, that's obviously a gap today. So and I don't want to say for every recommendation we're going to have a gap, but obviously for some there will be one. So calling those out is going to make it easier to identify when we look at our recommendations and solutions whether we address the major gap areas that we talked a lot about these during our discussions with the durable medical equipment. We just didn't capture it in a list. So that's what we're talking about here. And I do think it would be helpful to have for the final paper. So, again, I was hoping that someone would volunteer to just take a stab at it. Again, it doesn't have to be 100% complete, but at least the start of a list that we could share with this task force in a future meeting and then build off of. And not hearing any volunteers.
I agree. Deb Strickland just put her hand up.
Yep. So, Alex, I can take a stab at that if you want. Do you need that in 1 week's time?
I think we have a couple of weeks we can work on this, Deb. Alex, okay. What do you think?
I think that's spot on. You know, it would be really great because if then maybe within 2 weeks we would have a draft list that maybe we could come back and look at on another call. I mean, we've been pulling a lot of the pieces together, and this is definitely a missing component, dare I say, a gap in the sort of our documentation. So I would appreciate that support, Deb.
Yeah, sure. And so, I mean, even on the next week's meeting, I can actually show maybe some progress, but maybe not be fully through it, but I can certainly start, give it a start.
That would be fabulous. And unfortunately, Cheryl's not going to be with us next week, but we can carry forward this request.
Yes, and I actually just put like a couple things on paper, Deb, so I can send those to you, and at least you won't have to start with a blank page in front of you.
Okay, sounds great.
Perfect. Okay. All right, so thank you for that. I really appreciate it. You know, this is a hard job that we have all here in addition to our regular work days. So next week we are going to do more deep dive. Alex is going to leave the entire meeting, as she mentioned. I'm not going to be here next week, and really talk about the recommendations. Also, I believe Jim and Josh are going to provide a final review and wrap-up of the data classes. There were some adjustments made to that wording that had not yet been shared. And then for next steps, we've got the next couple of meetings specced out in the deck regarding looking at, when I come back on the 21st, an integrated federal data model discussion as a recommendation. And also we want to move into the convergence of clinical and administrative data and do a deep dive. We also wanted to then talk about the draft report writing and then hopefully have assignments for all of the task force members to take on just a small component of that final paper so we can bring it all back together and then have something we can review as a whole. And obviously it will require a lot of review by this team as a group because we all won't be writing with one voice. But hopefully once we've reviewed it a few times, we will be able to have something that makes sense and flows as the task force is hoping. Any questions on next steps? Want to thank everybody for today. I think this was a really great meeting, and I want to thank Hans for the presentation from EHRA. It was very, very helpful, generated a lot of good discussion. Alex, did you want to add anything?
I think you said it very nicely.
All right. Well, I want to thank everybody again for their time and commitment to this important activity, and we hope you have a wonderful week.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.